We're going to start the State Government Finance Committee hearing. Members, we've got a full schedule, so I appreciate those of you that showed up on time so that we can start. We have in your packets today the minutes. Representative Anderson moves the minutes for March 25th. All those in favor of the March 25th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. Because I am the only author here of a bill so far, I'm going to start with my bill. That is House File 1467. This is the Hennepin County Railroad issue. Members, for those of you that haven't heard this bill yet in other committees, what we are doing here is that we are making it so that it's clear in statute that Hennepin County has the authority to recognize public safety concerns when it comes to eminent domain proceedings dealing with the railroad. And so this makes it clear and puts it into statute for us. There is no fiscal note attached to this, no fiscal cost, I should say. I do have folks here that could testify to it if you wish, but we don't have to go that route if that's the desires of the committee. So with that, I am going to offer it up to anybody that wishes to testify for or against the bill, and then we'll go over questions. So if there's anyone from the public that wishes to testify to this bill, please come forward. Thank you, Mr. Sutter. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I am John Sutter. I'm the Acting Community Development Director for the City of Crystal. I do have some handouts for the committee, if there is a page available. Thank you. I know you've got a busy agenda, so I'll be brief in my comments.
Mike, welcome, like Commissioner, if you want to state your name for the record as well. And who?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Mike Opat, Hennepin County Commissioner. Well, I think we're here today with the bill asking the committee to really validate the county's public safety role by allowing a clarifying provision in state law where when the county and government owns land that the if the railroad wants that land, that the decision would be that the county's public interests are primary to those of the railroad. We have a situation, and Mr. Sutter can describe it, where unbeknownst to any local government, any of the cities that are involved in these cities are Plymouth to the west, beginning in the west, Plymouth, New Hope, Crystal, Minneapolis, or Crystal, Robbinsdale, Golden Valley, and Minneapolis. The Burlington Northern Railroad approached the Canadian Pacific Railroad, which carries long oil trains and other heavy freight trains west to east along their line that goes through those cities and goes through Plymouth, New Hope, Crystal, and Minneapolis into the BN Yard in northeast Minneapolis. That's happened for as long as I can remember. I've represented this area for 20 years. I've lived in the area my entire life. That's a heavy freight rail line. Everybody understands that. We all deal with it. There are only two grade separations on that line. The rest are at grade, but we live with it. However, the plan that was revealed, actually discovered, not revealed, to the local governments was that Burlington Northern wanted those CP trains to be rerouted in Crystal, then travel south on a little-used Monticello subdivision of the BN line, go through split downtown Robbinsdale, one train a day, maybe 5 to 7 cars, one or two trains at the most are run on that line now. That line doesn't go anywhere. It goes out to Monticello and stops at the river. There's maybe one or two customers on there. But anyway, these long trains, 4,000 or more feet, 100 or more cars, would then be diverted through downtown Robbinsdale, through Golden Valley, through Minneapolis parkland and wetlands down there, back up through downtown Minneapolis under Target Field, across Nicollet Island, and then it would avoid the north yards, the northeast yards, Shoreham yards, Northtown yards, are kind of called both depending on who you talk to, before heading east. And our primary concern is, one, what those long trains would do in terms of blocking up to 5 at-grade intersections at the same time. intersections where, or that line actually is adjacent to the, well, the Robbinsville Police Department and Fire Department sit on that line. It's in their backyard. If you stopped traffic at Rockford Road, a very busy county road, County Road 9, as well as West Broadway, Noble Avenue, 39th and a half Avenue, you would effectively cut off public safety first responders from getting either to the station to go out on a call or from the station to go to a call. So those are our primary concerns. The county acted upon learning of this plan to inquire with the railroads, did not get satisfactory answers as to the plan, was not apprised of what, and neither were any of the cities, of what was really going to happen here. And so we acted to purchase a property that would prevent this crossing. The county owns that property. It was an effort out of really a last resort kind of effort. We didn't have any other tools to try to get some sort of cooperative posture from the railroads. And we just didn't feel like we could stop it or have a reasonable conversation about it. Every elected official representing every one of the cities I mentioned, and every state legislator representing the cities I've mentioned, is in support of our effort. And so far at the legislature, we've enjoyed the cooperation of each committee we've sat in. Madam Chair, and I want to thank you for your work on this matter as well.
We have one question, and then I think that we have another testifier that wishes to speak to this bill. So, Representative Johnson, or did you want to wait until the other testifier? Okay. So, anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill, please come forward. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. I'm here in opposition to this bill. A few misstatements of fact, apparently, about the traffic flow would be and so on. In a nutshell, as was well documented last year, there were a number of service issues on the rail system, particularly BNSF Railway in Minnesota and throughout the upper Midwest. Last September, there was a joint hearing of five committees of the Minnesota Legislature to deal strictly with the subject of rail service issues. It was made very clear that the capacity in the track system was not sufficient for the growth in traffic, and that the state, the Surface Transportation Board, and our customers expected us to do something about it. At that point, we outlined that we had several projects in the works for Minnesota and Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, that would increase our capacity. One of the projects that we put on our list this year was this Crystal Connector. The reason that we're doing it is that there is a large bottleneck. One of the biggest bottlenecks on our system is in Minneapolis. It's where CP trains transition onto BNSF tracks. Currently, about 24 trains a day, I think, operate on that CP track through Crystal. Half of those go to Shoreham Yard. The other half go to CP's yard in St. Paul. Their access to that yard is by trackage rights over BNSF Railway. At the point where those 12 trains a day, that's the current level, come onto our tracks, because of the limitations of the curvature and so on, they're limited to speeds of under 10 miles an hour. So while they're making that move, they block our north-south main lines for more than 20 minutes at a time, total of about 4 hours a day that our tracks north and south are shut down. This causes backup of traffic in other locations. It brings everything to a halt. You've probably heard of the complaints in the northern suburbs extending up into Anoka County and beyond about block crossing issues there, trains parked, trains idling. This is the primary reason why. It's our trains waiting for the CP trains. So what we're looking to do is have a different interchange point where CP would come onto our track at Crystal, about 12 trains a day right now, as I said, at current levels. This has run into strong opposition, but the real problem is that right now we're under the gun. We've been told eliminate all the bottlenecks. This is one of the biggest ones. We're spending $6 billion this year on our capital program, about $325 million in Minnesota for track capacity and upgrades. What we're doing is leaving one of the biggest choke points in place if we can't build this particular project. We have said that we will look for options, but right now this is the only option we know of that works. If this is taken off the table, the implications go far beyond Hennepin County. It has ramifications for other counties in Minnesota, certainly for Anoka County, Ramsey County. It has implications for the entire state with the industries such as agriculture, mining, forest products, power generation that rely on the efficient flow of traffic through the Twin Cities area. So this is far bigger than a one county situation, and to give one county veto power over the over a project that has statewide and regional implications, I think would be bad policy. Thank you.
All right, and Commissioner, did you want to respond at all?
Well, Madam Chair and members, I think this is part of the frustration we have. The this committee has been on the, or this committee has been a stop for this bill for a long time. This is the, I don't know how many numbers of hearings we've had. I've testified that this is my third, I think. The BN representative is here. There are no maps before you. There is no plan before you. There's a tell of a $6 billion spend. This isn't even roughly approaching 1/1,000th of that, and there's no, and yet this is the biggest choke point. So you can, I think, as elected officials, you can understand our frustration at the local level when you talk about cutting a suburb in two with more than mile-long trains, and the railroad comes here with virtually no information. So, you know, I at the start of the testimony was suggested I made misstatements. I'd be happy to make whatever statements that were backed up by facts that the railroad provided, but there frankly haven't been any. So in my conversations with Burlington Northern officials, I've had just a couple at the Fort Worth, Texas level where the management lies. It was suggested to me that there are other options. This is not the only other option. I think the railroad should pursue those.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Policy question first. I represent part of the city of St. Paul, and we've had our difficulties dealing with the railroad, and they always seem to come through on top. My question is does this legislation, is it strong enough so it's going to be able to accomplish what you want, or do you see further litigation on this kind of legislation?
Commissioner?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I would hope it is strong enough. It would clarify state law very clearly, where if the government owned a piece of land that our public safety interests, it's written narrowly around public safety. It just isn't any sort of capricious purchase of land by government. We have to have a designated reason, and so we think it's the best we can do right now. But I certainly appreciate the question and the concern going forward.
Representative Johnson.
Then one question for you, Madam Chair, if I may. Where's the motion for this to go?
It's going to go to the General Register.
Good. Well, good luck.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? All right. Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 1467 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. Members, we are going to go to Representative Detmer's bill. Representative Howe has agreed to present it because Representative Detmer right now is currently presenting a different bill in another committee. For our schedule, some of these items will not be coming to us until later on this afternoon, so we will. That's why we have to come back and do an evening hearing. So my apologies for that. It's just reality of the timing of things. So we're going to do Detmer's bill, and then we are going to do Representative Sanders' bill, and then and you said we could do this one. Okay. All right. With that, Representative Howe, if you could introduce House File 146, and I believe that we are sending this one to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will move House File 146 to go to the General Register.
Thank you. And Representative Howe, can you give us a little background on the bill?
Members, I think we've probably all seen this bill at least once before, and this actually just gives us the flexibility of honoring those that have fallen in service to our country, and given us the option to give them the honor and remembrance flag. And the honor and remembrance flag does not replace anything that we currently do, does not supplant anything that's current but it gives us another option and another way and to provide some a significant piece of a way to honor these folks that have given all for, in the service of our country and especially from our state. So in that regard, I'd like to turn to my testifier and phone a friend here to help me give some more background on this specific piece of legislation.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Sure. My name is Pat LaBelle, and I'm on the board of the Minnesota Chapter of Honor and Remember. I thank you for hearing us today. In the way of a little background of the flag, my husband and I met Gold Star Father George Lutz at a National Patriot Guard rally in Ogden, Utah in the summer of 2009. His son, Tony, had died in the Battle of Fallujah, 12/29/05. George visited with many Gold Star families after the funeral and found that all families had two things in common. Number one, they wanted to know their sacrifice was not in vain, and two, the nation wouldn't forget their fallen heroes. George did a lot of research and talked with legislators in Virginia and found there's never been a universal symbol dedicated to those who made the ultimate sacrifice in service to our country. The legislators said, go for it, and the Honor and Remember flag was born. George spent a year designing the Honor and Remember flag. In your handout, there's a short sheet explaining what all the symbolism, the colors and the symbols mean. So I'd like to refer to that. The Honor and Remember flag recognizes all individuals who died as a result of serving in the U.S. military from the founding of our nation to present day. It serves as a symbol of national gratitude and remembrance for Americans who paid for our freedoms with their lives. There's a very small group, 8 or 9 individuals, that disagree with this flag in Minnesota. One reason is that this flag has a trademark on it. Bannon Flag Company was the first major flag company to be allowed to make the flag. Several other flag companies have also been granted the trademark. The reason for the trademark is lessons learned from the POW MIA flag. It was not protected by trademark, and because of that, not only did the design fluctuate, but it's made all over the world, including China and Vietnam. The trademark for Honor and Remember is not held in anyone's name, and anyone or everyone involved in design have legally released all rights. It is of utmost importance to protect the symbol and inhibit it from being altered or produced outside of the United States. Another objection by this group is that the Honor and Remember flag will replace the American flag on caskets. This is absolutely not true at all. It's ridiculous. I have two articles that were put in the Minnesota Legionnaire newsletter stating these false claims, and unfortunately this went out to everyone who's a Legion member in Minnesota. Included in your packet of information are frequently asked questions on the flag and the organization, a letter from the Vice President of Annan Flag Company addressing the issues brought forth by the aforementioned group of individuals, flag etiquette, where it goes on the pole, and a press release from this past November awarding Honor and Remember with the prestigious top-rated 2014 nonprofit award. To date, 21 states have, we just got Florida on Tuesday, have adopted the Honor and Remember flag, including neighboring Wisconsin and South Dakota. 5 other states have endorsed the flag, and legislation is pending in about 20 others. We do expect additional states to adopt the flag this legislative session. It only took about 3 weeks for Wisconsin to act on adopting the flag last year, and the regional commander of the American Legion and state commander of the VFW were there to help push the bill through. I hope you can see this. It's a picture of a flag presentation at the Apple Valley American Legion on April 22, 2012. We had 17 families in this presentation. We flew in George Lutz from Virginia to speak, and Governor Dayton also made an appearance and spoke to the families and the guests. As you can see, the Gold Star families get special hand-sewn flags, I'm sorry, with the name of the fallen hero, the date of death, and the theater in which they died. Donations are used for these very special flags, and our most generous donors have been individual American Legions and VFWs. These same organizations also were proud to participate in many of the flag presentations using their facilities and their honor guard in most cases. I just want to let you know the flag prices are a 3x5 is $50. That's what most places would fly. 4x6 is $79, and the only 5x8 that would probably be flown is at the Capitol, and that's under $200. I have a 5x8 that I would donate back to the state gladly. Governor Pawlenty flew it over the Capitol on July 22, 2010, when George Lutz was making his rounds to educate on the flag. Now is the time to vote on this bill with your hearts and minds and join the other 26 states in the union that have already adopted or endorsed the Honor and Remember flag. Please let these families know their heroes will forever be honored and remembered when they see this flag flying throughout the state of Minnesota. And it's also a huge reminder for all of the public that our freedom and homeland safety does not come without a price. I would just like to tell you a quick story about one of our flag presentations early on when our chapter was being formed in Minnesota. The Northeast Lions organization wanted to honor one of their neighborhood fallen heroes, Private First Class Marlon Troxell. The family wanted this flag to be a surprise for their mother, and I'm not real big on surprises for this, but we do as the family wishes. They had a fundraiser at Elsie's in Northeast Minneapolis, and there was a very large crowd there. The mother wasn't going to come because sitting in a bowling alley on a sunny Saturday afternoon for an 80-plus woman is probably not very appealing, but they finally got her to come. And when we presented the flag, I will never, ever forget this. She came up and touched my arm, and she looked up at me and with tears in her eyes and said, "I thought everybody forgot but me." And ladies and gentlemen, that's what this is all about. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill? If so, if you can come forward, please. If you can please state your name. And anyone else that wishes to speak to the bill, feel free to please come forward and sit in the chairs back there. And if you can state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Tracy Clark. I am a Gold Star mom. Good morning. We're happy to be here to honor our fallen heroes and to give and to all the Gold Star families. Our son was killed by a rocket propelled grenade. He was doing his job, leading soldiers to their base, keeping them safe, and hoping by doing his job, he would be keeping us safe back home. Ryan was KIA'd October 4th, 2010, in Shekabek, Afghanistan. And like every Gold Star family, Ryan and their loved ones are very missed, not only on special days, but every day. Our memories may fade, even for a mother and a father who have lost a child, and it frightens me. But the flag reminds everyone of the men and women who lost their lives from the beginning of all wars to the present time. Something to think about. Where would we be without our military men and women? Where would we be? When it comes time to say yes or no for flying the Honor and Remembrance flag, please remember what our loved ones did for our country and for our freedom. Remember, before you say yes and no, think about who you're saying no to. All we want is for people to never forget our fallen heroes. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your son's service. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill? If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Valerie Kennedy. I'm a Gold Star parent. I'd like to thank the committee today for your time and consideration. Our lives changed on April 15th, 2011, when an Army chaplain and a notification officer knocked on our front door. They didn't need to speak the words, we knew. On behalf of a grateful nation,
We regret to inform you that your son, Joseph Allen Kennedy, has been killed in the line of duty in Ghazni Province, Afghanistan. You have our deepest condolences. So began our journey, a journey that has repeated itself over the course of history. The true cost of freedom is buried in the ground. How to honor a fallen man by Ron Noden. To honor a fallen man, you cannot fall yourself. You hold fast and steady. You finish the task at hand. You become more than you thought you ever could, and you do more than you ever dreamed you would. To honor a fallen man, you embrace that man in your soul. You make that man a part of who you are and what you do. You relinquish no quarter in the fight for what is right, and you champion those that carry on his work. To honor a fallen man is painful, difficult, and challenging. To honor a fallen man is the greatest honor you can give him. As you honor his memory, you perpetuate his existence, and you relish the bond with that man to keep his memory vibrant. To honor a fallen man, you progress in the process of honoring him. To honor him, you eventually move past grieving for him, and you reach a moment of change to pride, joy, and optimism. And as you heal, you find ways to help others heal. This poem became very poignant in our lives, and it was a turning point for us. Part of our healing journey also began with the Honor and Remember organization on April 9th of 2012, when we were presented the personalized flag that you see here today. We have publicly flown this very special flag in Invergrove here on April 15th to honor and remember Joe's service and sacrifice. This great republic in which we live has been built on the blood, sweat, and tears shed by brave men and women throughout its history. This flag represents the many lives that it served and paid the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom. We are proud of Joe and his contribution to our country. The Honor and Remember flag is a distinctive symbol to remind the general public of the true cost of freedom. I ask each of you here today to pass this bill in support of those that gave their lives in service. And in doing so, you reassure the many Gold Star families across the nation that their loved one will not be forgotten. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Ron McAdance. I'm from out by Candy High, Minnesota. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I've been working with Pat and Mike Labelle on this Honor and Remember flag for going on, 4 years? So anyway, I'm down here to testify in support of this flag. I've had the privilege of presenting these flags in Minnesota, South Dakota, and also in Arizona. When we give one of these flags to a Gold Star family, I don't know what more we can possibly give to show that family that their loved one will never be forgotten. And to be able to be a part of that is very meaningful for me. I've got some... I wrote up some notes here so that I could get out to everything I wanted to today. So if you will bear with me, I'll go over that. While there still remains an attitude among some members of the area that they are in a position to do what's best for the veterans of our great state, I come before you as a twice wounded combat veteran of the Vietnam War to tell you that those groups in no way speak for me. I am a life member of the Society of the 1st Infantry Division, life member of Disabled American Veterans, life member of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, and the Bandito Charlie Association, which was the company I served with in Vietnam. I am also a member of the VFW, the American Legion, the 48, and have been honored with being a distinguished member of the 16th Infantry Regiment. I'm very active in working with veterans and veterans' issues wherever I can help. There have been claims that we are trying to replace the Stars and Stripes with this new flag. As Pat said, nothing can be further from the truth. We all fought and served under Old Glory. That is a flag that represents each and every one of us as Americans. What if people in Minnesota would have stood up and said, we don't need a state flag, Old Glory is our flag? What if our military units were to say, what do we need a unit flag for? We have Old Glory. If Congress would have turned down the MIA POW flag and said that all of our MIA POWs were represented by Old Glory, which they are, the MIA POW flag would never proudly fly over our government buildings. It did, in fact, take many years for the POW-MIA flag to be passed through. All of our flags represent a group of people. Old Glory, of course, represents all of us as Americans. Our state flag represents each and every one of us as citizens of Minnesota. Unit flags represent individual units of our military. Professional sports teams even have flags for their teams. You might say that these flags represent special interest groups. What it boils down to is that we all have special interests, and we're all parts of a special interest group of our own. The Honor and Remember flag represents a very special group. It represents all of the men and women who have shed their blood on foreign soil and gave their lives so that you and I may enjoy the freedoms we hold so dear. For the families of these young men and women, the Honor and Remember flag is one more symbol of the appreciation for the sacrifice that has been made by their loved one. We are not asking for any funding. We are not asking for any mandates. All we are asking the state of Minnesota for is to join the 26 other states who have recognized the Honor and Remember flag and now allow it to be flown over our state capitol buildings and other government buildings on 12 days out of the year, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, 4th of July, and so on. It may be flown every day if so desired. I feel that to not approve this flag would be a slap in the face to the families of our fallen youth who have given their all. I urge you to pass this bill, HF 146, and move it on to the House floor. Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions of me? I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Great, thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome. If you can please state your name for your record.
My name is Mike McDonald. Madam Chair and members, my comments are going to be very brief, as they've already covered some of the information that I had previously prepared. I am a Vietnam combat veteran, life member of the DAV, VVA, VFW, 28th Infantry Regimental President, and life member of the 1st Infantry Division. Quite frankly, I've been a little bit confused in why this is considered a veteran issue at all. I think it is an issue for the entire American public. I don't think that legislatures across the country that have considered this a veteran issue, I think that assumption is invalid. Veterans have no corner on the market of grief, loss, or sacrifice. This flag should have been around since America's earliest wars. It is simply a special recognition for the families who have sacrificed the most, and a public reminder of the cost of freedom by those born by those families. Conversely, it could also be considered an anti-war symbol because it suggests a rethinking of the sacrifices we ask our soldiers and their families to make. I am proud that our representatives have understood the need for this powerful symbol. We cannot recognize the special significance of our falling if we cannot recognize the special significance of our fallen. We have failed in expecting any future family's willingness to send a son or daughter into harm's way. And lastly, again, this flag is in no way designed to replace, used in place of, or conflict with the stars and stripes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill? Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair and the committee members. Most of you have seen me at almost any veteran issue down here at the Capitol, and I agree with the gentleman in front of me. This shouldn't be a veteran issue. This should be an issue for everybody. I'm chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council of Minnesota, and our council unanimously voted to endorse this flag. I have Old Glory at home in a nice oak case sitting next to my TV that was given to me by for my father. I couldn't imagine losing my son and him not being recognized. So I ask you to please pass this forward. Thank you.
All right, members, are there any questions at all? Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. To the Gold Star families, thank you for your sacrifice. And members, let's pass this out and get it on the floor.
Is there any other questions? Representative Earhart.
I was late, Madam Chair, and I apologize, but who designed this flag and why is it? Is there some specific, or was it a contest, or...
Sure. And if
Pat LaBelle.
Right ahead. Go ahead.
The flag was designed by a Gold Star father who lost his son in the Battle of Fallujah. And it took him about a year to put it together just right. Everything has a meaning on it.
Representative Earhart, in your packet is the description of the symbolism of the flag. And if you need a copy, I can give you mine. Any further follow-up, Representative Earhart?
Well, some of you know that I'm a veteran, a combat veteran, and sometimes I think we do things that... because of that there's a lot of emotion involved in this. I, for one, don't particularly care for the design of that flag, but that's just a personal opinion. And I suppose it could be anything that, any kind of design that has on it the name of someone who passed because of combat service, but I just don't think it's a very good-looking flag, I'm sorry. I understand it could be any kind of a flag as long as it does this, but... And do I understand that we're now adopting this as the state's entry into this with, was I here, 27 other states have done this or something like that?
Yes, Representative Earhart.
You know, Madam Chair, when we were trying to do something about the state flag, which needs designing, we had a couple of times I carried that bill because it could use a little more pep in it than it is, and we had batteries of people doing the design work on it. We never did change it. Now we're expecting to adopt this. I don't know if I'm not an artist, but it doesn't catch my eye very much, but.
Okay.
Whatever.
Thank you for your feedback. Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Earhart, a year from now, maybe none of us in here will remember what the flag looked like, or 10 years from now, but I, for one, and I'm assuming many others in here also will remember what the flag represents, which is the intent of any banner, whether military or otherwise. You're trying to make about the fourth thing the first thing.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Earhart.
We do have that black and white MIA flag that everybody recognizes because it was put forth in the correct manner. And I think that's maybe even accepted by the federal government as part of the symbolic of the missing in action.
Okay.
And I don't know what, you know.
Okay.
Has anybody in this group ever heard about this before we walked in here? Was it today?
Well, Representative Earhart, it was heard in the Veterans Division, so yes.
Excuse me?
It was, I'm sorry, Representative Earhart. It was heard in the Veterans Division, so yes.
Madam Chair.
And Representative Howe.
This has been here at the legislature a couple of years. So this is not the first year this has come forward. We've heard this numerous times in numerous years. And so it's not the first run at this. I hope it's the last. I hope this is what we need to do and get it done. I see the author of the bill walked in now. And if he wants to say a few words, I would definitely turn the gavel over to him or the podium over here for this. But Madam Chair, I guess what I want to emphasize here is I'm probably
well. Thank you, Representative.
I hate to say it, but this is and I get on folks for being too emotional and doing things on emotion. Should do it on fact. And I believe the fact is we can't do enough to honor these folks that do this. And it strikes me because I had to make the toughest thing I ever had to do in my life.
You know, we are very blessed here at the legislature. We have many members that have served both in combat and just in our military in general, and we thank them all for their service. Representative Detmer, you arrived just at the right moment. We are going to vote on this bill. It's House File 146. Representative Howe renews his motion that House File 146 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Congratulations, Representative Detmer. Your bill is moving to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Okay.
Sorry. Representative Sanders.
Was that on your packet?
Yep.
I got the other one. This is our...
Welcome, Representative Sanders. I'm going to move House File 337 be referred to the General Register. With that, if you could introduce your bill and walk us through it, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 337 is the Campaign Finance Board's technical bill. With me here today is Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board to help us walk through the bill or answer any questions that we have, as he is the expert on all this stuff.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. rather than go through the entire bill, I will start with the provisions that have some financial implications. Members of the committee, there is no fiscal note on this bill, and there is no recognizable fiscal impact, which is the reason there's no fiscal note. This bill does sort of routine things and non-controversial things that the board's technical slash non-controversial bill typically does each year. And in some cases, those things will result in some savings because we become more efficient in administration. In some cases, they'll actually result in savings, we hope, because they make the law more clear, and thus there'll be fewer violations and fewer questions about it. There are a few provisions that have actual financial implications in the bill, but those all relate to late filing fees and civil penalties. And historically, the agency has never budgeted, and MMB agrees with this position, that we do not budget for late filing fees or civil penalties in the board's operations. Those monies are always deposited in the general fund of the state. That's a statutory requirement in Chapter 10A. And they are so unpredictable that any guess that we would make would likely be far from the mark. Some years they can be high. For example, after the 2012 election, we had one investigation where there was a $100,000 civil penalty. That's very rare, happens once every 10 or 12 or 15 years. Typically, they're fairly small. Also, if we were doing our job perfectly in educating treasurers and candidates and PACs the way we would like to, there wouldn't be any late filing fees or civil penalties. So our goal is always to reduce these amounts. But let me just touch on the sections of the bill that deal with financial matters. And the first one would be Section 5 of the bill. And there are three sections that are similar to this. This is a section that relates to the requirement that a public official who represents someone else for money before a state agency has to file a notice with the board of that representation disclosure. And the late filing fee for failing to do that is $5 a day. This provision would increase that to $25 a day with a maximum of $1,000. Over the last several years, the legislature has been addressing all of these late filing fees in the same way, increasing them to $25 per day with a maximum of $1,000. So this does the same thing to make this provision consistent with most of the others, including the requirement that you file campaign finance reports. It would now be the same level of penalty as your campaign finance report filing. The next section is Section 10, which is, again, a late filing fee increase. This is the requirement that a political committee or fund register with the board within 14 days after meeting the financial thresholds for registration. And again, the increase would be from $5 to $25 per day with a maximum of $1,000. Moving on to section, clear up on page 16, section 19 of the bill. This adds a new civil penalty, and actually, it, in our estimation, it provides a less stringent remedy than the remedy that's there now. Under current law, if a candidate who did not sign a public subsidy agreement issues a PCR receipt so that the donor can get the money back, the candidate who doesn't sign a public subsidy agreement is not supposed to do that. And under current law, that's a crime. It's a misdemeanor. And that's the only penalty. This would add a civil penalty of up to $3,000 that could be imposed by the board. And that's the typical level of civil penalty that the other provisions of Chapter 10A permit, up to $3,000. It also does add one additional prohibition, and that is, even if you did sign a public subsidy agreement, if you issue a receipt to somebody who's not qualified to get one, for example, somebody who didn't give you any money, that would be also a misdemeanor and subject to a civil penalty. Issuing these receipts is really just like giving out money, essentially, because the recipient of the receipt can file that with the Department of Revenue and get $50 back or $100 back for a couple filing jointly. The next section is the one right below that, which is Section 20. This is a new penalty, and this relates to Chapter 211B. A couple of years ago, the legislature gave the board jurisdiction over certain provisions of the Fair Campaign Practices Act, but only as they relate to candidates, party units, and PACs over which we already have jurisdiction. And those provisions were how you can use money that you raise for political purposes, the corporate contribution prohibition, and the prepared and paid for disclaimer, so that now you have somebody that you can ask questions about if you want some clarification on those laws. When those matters were heard only by the OAH and still by the OAH for local candidates, the OAH has a blanket statute that allows them to issue $5,000 civil penalties. The board doesn't have any blanket civil penalty authority. If you want us to have civil penalty authority, it goes in each separate provision. So this provision would allow the board to issue civil penalties of up to $3,000 for those sections in 211B that don't already include their own civil penalty provision. As I was going through that, I realized I did miss one other late filing fee increase. There were actually three in the bill, and if member wants me to identify the third one, I'll go back and find it. But there were three of those where the late filing fee is increased from $5 to $25. And then finally, I want to point out one provision that looks like it has a financial implication, but it does not. And if you turn to page 20, section 28, costs assessed, you'll see that provision. This is an amendment to section 211B.37. And that's a statute that's not actually under the board's jurisdiction. But I'll give you just a very brief background on why this was there and why it needs to be changed. Quite a long time ago, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and still in most cases, hears complaints under Chapter 211B, which is the Fair Campaign Practices Act. Prior to the OAH getting jurisdiction over that chapter, county attorneys were required to handle complaints, and both at the state election level and at the local level. And county attorneys found that burdensome. They didn't want to do it. And a law was passed to put that authority and responsibility with the Office of Administrative Hearings. At that time, of course, there was no money, the OAH being a revolving fund agency. And so the statute was written so that for complaints regarding state candidates, those under the board's jurisdiction, $130,000 per biennium was set aside from the public subsidy appropriation to be transferred to the OAH, and they would bill against that for those complaints. And at that time, the counties were billed back individually for local candidate complaints, and so OAH was covered for all of their costs. Some years subsequently, actually in 2009, both the board and the OAH realized that this idea of setting aside $130,000 from the public subsidy program that OAH would bill against didn't make a lot of sense. And in that biennium, so for 10-11, the money was directly appropriated to OAH. So if you look at those budgets, you'll see $130,000 appropriation directly to OAH. And at the same time, the direct appropriation for the public subsidy was reduced by that amount, so there was no fiscal impact. There was a rider that was still included that said if there was any money left over, it went back to the public subsidy program. And during the first biennium, there was, but subsequent to that, there hasn't been any money left over. Part of the reason that there has been no money left over is because a couple of years later, the counties were successful in getting the statute amended to eliminate the charge back to counties for local elections. And section 211B.37 then read as you see it in the bill, but without the changes. What that actually meant, and I don't know if anybody really recognized it at the time, but that by that point, the OAH still had the $130,000, but was then required to handle not only the state complaints, which was taking up all of that money, but also local complaints, and there was no new funding provided. And that's why you've seen in the last couple of years, including the last couple of bienniums, including this one, that the OAH runs a deficit and has to come in for a deficiency appropriation because there's actually no real funding provided for local complaints. This bill does only one thing, and that is it deletes the obsolete language that was left at the time we moved the appropriation directly to OAH. We should have removed the language that's told OAH to assess the cost of state complaints back to the public subsidy program. They haven't been doing that since 2009, so we're in the third biennium now where that has not been done. And I've met with Judge Poos. She understands this language and, of course, has no intention of trying to charge public subsidy program for complaints for which they're now directly funded. So this simply removes obsolete language, does not change how the funding or the billing has worked for the last three bienniums. And that concludes the provisions that have financial implications, Madam Chair, and I'll stand for questions on any part of the bill.
First, is there anyone that wishes to speak to this bill from the public? Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm looking at sections 4 and 5 of the bill where you eliminate the 10-day grace period. Now, I've probably filed as many reports as anybody here, and I've never been late. But first of all, I'd be interested in knowing why we originally had a 10-day grace period, and what would be some of the circumstances that might lead to somebody filing late. You know, illness out of the country might be a couple of examples where someone might, for some reason or another, file late. And so I think it's important to know why we gave a grace period, whatever the number of days, and then secondly, how often and why does someone file late?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Carlson. That's a good question. I can't exactly answer the first part as to why there was a grace period in the first place, because these filings are not required the moment something happens. There's always a built-in period before the filing is even required. So, for example, registration of a political committee or fund is not required until 14 days after the threshold has been met. The notice of representation is not required. I believe that's 14 days. It might be 10 days after the representation has occurred. And then the late filing fee doesn't occur until, under previous law, until an additional grace period, usually 10 days after that. And I cannot tell you why that was. What I can tell you in particular is our experience, and it was most prominent in the lobbyist disclosure filing requirement. Before the so-called grace period was eliminated, a very high percentage of lobbyists were technically late in filing. They were supposed to file within, by a certain filing date, a date specific in the statute, and they didn't, but almost all lobbyists filed before the late filing fee kicked in. So we had something like, I believe, in excess of 90% didn't file by the technical due date, but well over 90% filed before the late filing fee occurred. Now that there is no grace period, more than 90% of lobbyists filed by the due date. So it was a matter of changing their approach. So again, I cannot tell you why the original grace period was involved. I will tell you that the board does have the ability and regularly waives late filing fees for cases of illness, family problems, and often will even reduce a fee just because a person didn't understand the requirements. So the board does have flexibility in those cases where it's appropriate to make an adjustment.
No, Madam Chair, the reason I asked the question, you know, I always look at things like this so that we don't have any unintended consequences, and so maybe your last statement covers that. If you have the authority, then, if there were extenuating circumstances, to waive the penalty.
Mr. Goldsmith?
That satisfies my concern, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author on Section 27. I've heard a little bit about that. Could you explain what the rationale is for that and what your intent is as far as the new language?
Representative Johnson, can you say the section again that you're referring to?
Section 27.
Okay.
The new language, 19.27.
Okay. Mr. Goldsmith?
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to the author on this. This section and a similar section in the definition of contribution were amendments in the first policy committee of the bill, and the board worked with the authors of the amendments to make sure that we understood what was intended and we would be able to administer the law, but the board did not have a position on the actual substance of the amendments.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's exactly what I was trying to get. I just want to know what the intent was. I know it's a policy question, but I would appreciate, since the bill is before us, to kind of hear what the rationale is.
Madam Chair and
Representative Sanders, excuse me.
So the intent, I believe, from the author of the amendment in the Elections Committee and some discussion before that, was that there was some clarification needed around signage. For instance, would it be okay to place a yard sign on a family farm if it was incorporated? You know, would that be a corporate contribution or not? And so in working with the board, we tried to come up with some language to hopefully provide some clarifying language. Similarly, even though it was a residence, if it was an advertised daycare, The business, they were an attorney or a tax preparer but worked out of their home. Were there any issues about placing a yard sign there? So the intent is just to provide some clarifying language as to, what is and isn't okay regarding signage and whether or not there would be corporate contributions included or not. To that point, this bill is designed to be hopefully 100% non-controversial. If there's problems with any of that language, we certainly can pull it out or make it better. We don't want anything to be non-controversial or things that we can't hopefully get almost 100% behind. So if there are problems or clarifications needed, we're certainly happy to take care of those.
Representative Johnson?
No, thank you. I was wondering if it was an attempt to make things more clear and less controversial. That sounds like that's what your intent is. Thank you, Madam
Chair. That is the intent, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Goldsmith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson and members. I did want to just explain how the board understands the two corresponding provisions to work. The first provision is actually on page 2 at line 2.9, which clarifies the definition of contribution, and it states that it is not a contribution for an individual to give permission to a candidate to put up a sign on any real property that is a residence. So that would permit then signs on even a corporately owned residential property. And then the provisions that Representative Johnson was talking about provide a corresponding release from the corporation that might own the property. And they do one additional thing, and that is that to provide that a corporation that is not a residential property, in other words, just a business in town, for example, would be permitted to put up one sign per candidate, not to exceed the limit specified, which I believe is 18 by 24, which I've been told by printers is the standard small sign. That is new, and that would not be recognized as a contribution either for the corporate contribution prohibition provision or for reporting purposes.
It's on that piece that Representative Sanders, in greater Minnesota, if it's a farm like you're highlighting, it'd probably be better to not limit the size of the sign on that, given, I mean, you're on a farm place. I think that that's kind of problematic. So that's my concern there. Representative Johnson, any further comments?
Just briefly, Mr. Goldsmith, then, on a business, then, would you be limited to one sign? So I see businesses, on both parties plastered sometimes with five or six signs. Is that the intent of that?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, and first let me back up to the Chair's concern. There is no limit on signs on residential-type property. So on a farm, they can put up the 4x8-foot billboard if they want to, whatever they prefer. The limit on signs is only for actual commercial property that is non-residential. And there are two approaches, or two answers, really, to your question, Representative Johnson. One is that in coordination with the candidate, so if the candidate comes to the business and says, I want to put up a sign and I'm not going to pay for it, I just want you to do it, they would be limited to one sign per candidate and the size that's specified. Now, even under existing law, a candidate could come to a business and say, I want to put up a big sign and I'm going to pay the fair market value, taking it out of being a contribution, and that would still be permitted.
Well, Mr. Goldsmith, even limiting it on the commercial side of it, there's some candidates that don't purchase an 18 by 24 size sign, so you're going to be making them go out and buy a specific sign. So the size part of it, I think, is problematic, but I'm going to let that go. We have Representative Mark Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Goldsmith, maybe you can help me out with something here on your section regarding the violations and enforcement. You got section 4, failure to file, subdivision 1, disclosure requirements, section 10, failure to file and penalties. First part of my question is, I see that these penalties, the daily rate is going up from $5 to $25. That's pretty significant. And the other fee is going from $100 to $1,000. That's pretty significant, too. My question is, why is there a need for these rates to go or these fees to go up. And my second question is, are there a lot of people out there that are violating these sections?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, the board's experience in the past, at least, with provisions that were more often used than these are not often used, has been that there seemed to be a tendency for people to consider a $5 per day fee capped at $100 to be insignificant enough not to actually worry about the requirement. And since that's the only, other than the law existing itself, the incentive to meet the requirement is the financial penalty, that has become insignificant over the years. The statute has been in place for certainly more than 20 years, and I can't go back beyond that at the same level. So the board has, the legislature has already increased those penalties in many other areas, and we felt that it was appropriate to bring these up to a point where they would have some meaning. Keep in mind that these are not things that are going to be imposed particularly on unsuspecting citizens. They relate to three different things. One is a public official representing somebody before a state agency for a fee. Another is a lobbyist who is required to register. And the third one is a political committee or fund required to register. So typically these are not citizens just going about their business, but they're people in a unique way becoming involved in government. And so that's the basis for the recommendation.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that's always bothered me is when government benefits financially from other people's misfortunes. That being said, I would assume that if you really wanted to give somebody a reason not to violate any of these things, why stop at $1,000? Why not, you know, again, $5,000, $10,000? That being said, I'm going to change the subject. I'm noticing here in Section 11 that I find this very fascinating. That to me, this is common sense in life. We've got something in here down in paragraph 932 about skywriting. We really need stuff like this in here. I know it's there. It's got a reason. But and there's also more language in here, other means of displaying and advertising. Does that mean that tagging railroad cards, this type of stuff, this type of behavior, I'm just kind of fascinated for this stuff to even be in a bill. It's there. I acknowledge it. But skywriting is actually in a bill.
Representative Sanders.
Well, Madam Chair, I get that. Mr. Goldsmith can certainly comment, but this section is saying that the disclaimers do not apply to these. Representative Anderson, when you are skywriting, I think you're one of the most uniquely qualified people to be able to do that in the legislature right now. But when you're skywriting your campaign banner, or your name above your district, you don't have to have a disclaimer underneath that.
Representative Anderson.
I think it's a unique provision for Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I wasn't really going to go there. I'd have to make some pretty big letters up there. But, again, just the fact that there was or there would even have to be a disclaimer in the first place, I guess that's where I was going with this. And there's so many different things, and it's going to be covered in the rest of that language, which says other means of displaying an advertisement. Again, it comes back down to common sense.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I may be the only person who actually had an opponent do skywriting against me, and we never thought to think about the disclaimer one. I think it was his only expense in the campaign. Did it over a U of M football game.
Go big or go home. Representative Kahn, any other...
And I got reelected anyway.
You did.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, if I, this is something that maybe was addressed and I'm not sure of it, but if I do not take public funding and I raise my total amount in the first year, which is now 62 plus, I guess, I blow through the level of that releases my opponents from who may have signed up for public funding in the first year, rather than whatever the under current law. It's sometime in July or August or wherever when you reach the threshold on which it releases your opponent. Now, has that been fixed in this, or how are we handling that? I know that I talked to Mr. Goldsmith at one time about this, and he said there were some corrections that needed to be made. I'm not sure that they were, or you didn't talk about them. So.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Earhart. There weren't any, the only technical corrections to the provisions relating to release from public subsidy were a couple of word changes to make the language, make it clear that the same approach applies now that we're in a two-year cycle that applied when we were in a individual year cycle. So it doesn't address any particular problem, but, and I'm not completely prepared to address that question today because there's nothing in the bill other than those technical changes. But the board's staff's analysis is that the law does work as written, and I'd be happy to have further conversations with you about it. And if there's something that seems not to work, we could look at that. But this bill, I think, will be ultimately, if it passes, will be going to conference committee because the bill is different in each body. And so if there's, I would like to talk to you further about that and see if we need to address something.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
No, but I think it's got to be addressed because it was a question in my race.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Yes, I have a question about the refund of the fine for the willful. It's the 16.4 in the bill. One of the things I can't, to an individual, is there any specifications about the individuals not eligible to claim a refund? For example, I guess it says a taxpayer. Is there a definition of taxpayer someplace? Or
Representative Kahn, what section are you in the bill?
16. I'm sorry, section 19 in the bill.
Section 19. Okay, Mr.
Page 16.5. So, I mean, one of the things that is sometimes, and I think what I've done is I've written if eligible on the refund thing. I don't know if that means that if I, but one of the things that's bothered me sometimes is that the return address will not be a Minnesota State return address. But I just don't know if that's the check that, you know, I assume it's someone who may have residences in two states. And how is that covered? I tried to figure it out from the statute, and I couldn't. So,
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the eligibility requirement is actually in, I believe it's Chapter 291. It's a Department of Revenue statute, and it does refer to a taxpayer, not necessarily a person who actually has to owe and pay taxes, but a person who would be a taxpayer if they had the obligation. I don't think that this statute in 10A gets that deep because what it says is that the person issuing the receipt would have to know that the person is not eligible. So typically the case we're thinking about is the person didn't give you any money, or you know the person has no contact to Minnesota, but you would have to have actual knowledge that the person is not eligible before you would violate this provision.
Well, Madam Chairman, I guess what I'm interested in what the connection to Minnesota has to be. I mean, what if the person is a foreign citizen or something like that, does that kick into it in any way?
Mr. Goldsmith or Mr. Gehring is here to help us out.
Mr. Gehring is great.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, one of the qualifications to be eligible for the refund program is that you have to be eligible to vote in Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
And so if you don't qualify that way, then you wouldn't qualify for the refund.
But, okay.
Representative Kahn, and I think it's all listed on the blue form that, or whatever form it is
right
now. It's listed all the things that you have to go through or to be.
But I guess the question is, willful means you have to have, prove that you knew that. You're just getting a name and an address, and you don't have to go check their eligibility to vote, and you don't have to check. You know, it's a felon or something. It's okay. I don't think I've gotten some recently, but I think I probably had some in the past, maybe before we had a refund.
So Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, so willful means that you had knowledge that the person was not eligible and you gave them a form anyway. So it's not that you didn't go in and check their background, it's that you knew in advance that they weren't eligible and you decided to give them the form.
Okay, so if you just, Kahn? Madam Chairman, if you just dumb and couldn't figure it out, it's not willful.
Mr. Garrett.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I think that's probably right, although Mr. Goldsmith probably should weigh in on that.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, it's the board's understanding that this does not impose any burden on the issuer of the, issuer of the receipt to check eligibility, but if they have this pre-existing knowledge and still issue a receipt, then it would be a violation.
Okay. Representative Howe, to this point.
Madam Chair, I think the follow-up with Representative Kahn answered my question, so that was great.
And Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you know, I was here when we passed a lot of this way back when and created the board and had a slightly different name. I think ethics or something was included in the title, and that didn't really fit. And later we passed legislation calling it the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And, you know, I commented earlier in this meeting about unintended consequences and so on. And I just have to say, I think in some respects, we're moving far beyond what the original intent, which was disclosure. And when we start having conversations about skywriting, I hadn't noticed that part of it until you brought it up. When we start talking about you can have one sign of a certain size on corporate property, I think that goes far beyond what the original intent of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board was. And I would just hope that the board begins to kind of take a step back and say, now, what was our original purpose? And the reason I bring up some of that, when you make it too complex and you have too many rules and regulations, you have to keep in mind, at least in legislative races, to some degree maybe even true in some of the other races, we're dealing with volunteers. You know, you get it too complex and try to get a treasurer. I commented the other day, I've been very fortunate. I've had two treasurers in 43 years. I might have sleepless nights if I had to find another one. So my point is, and my advice is, kind of keep what the original intent was. Keep it simple, because we don't want to put people in a position where they get caught up with a violation because there's something in here that deals with unintended consequences. Somebody that makes the mistake in a case that we reference corporate farms, and my gosh, happened to put up 2-yard signs for the same candidate on a farm, and they're in violation of the law. You know, I mean, that's not the original intent as one that was here. Maybe Representative Kahn was on the Government Operations Committee at the time. I think that's where the bill originally went through. And this, by the way, was part of the reform at kind of the height of Watergate. And so the feeling was, well, we have to have better laws for campaign disclosure. And that's where this all originated. And I'm all for that. It's just that I'm just saying, don't go too far to the point where we create situations with unintended consequences. And keep in mind, we're dealing with volunteers. And I compliment the board. They do provide training if you... for your campaign managers and volunteers and so on. So they try to do the best they can. And maybe some of this doesn't come from the board. Maybe it comes from others that have proposed various legislation through the years. I'm not sure. But if you would care to respond, that's fine. I was doing it maybe mainly to comment on what I viewed as the original intent, and we always debate what legislative intent was, but I think everybody could agree that that was the original intent, and it's all you have to do is look at what the title of the board is.
Well, and the fees on that, Mr. Goldsmith, is one of the concerns that I have, too, because it is just volunteers that are putting this together. And so I do have concerns about that. I have worked with the Campaign Finance Board for years, even prior to being a legislator myself. And I think that that's, the board has always said it's always about making sure that you comply. But I'm just curious on the fee end of it, based upon your knowledge of what your average fees are on a given election cycle, how much are we increasing that piece? And I know that you don't base your budget off of that, and I'm not implying that, but I do want to know, based on a traditional campaign year where both the House and the Senate are up, what can you expect the fee increase to be based upon these new numbers?
Madam Chair and members, the representation disclosure requirement is rarely used. Many years there are none. Occasionally there's one or two. I'm not sure if there's ever been a late filing fee. This is added in part for consistency with other fees in the statute, so that would typically be zero. When there is a representation disclosure statement, because it's filed by a public official, they often know about the statute and simply file the notice within the time frame that they're allowed to do that. The second fee provision that's increased here is lobbyist registration. And most people who are lobbyists, which means you have to be paid, more than $3,000 in a year in total to be a lobbyyist. More than $3,000 in a year to be a lobbyist. Those people typically know that they are lobbyists and typically know the registration requirement. We have a handful, and again, I'm talking about five or less, typically each year, of lobbyists that don't register on time. Because once we become aware that they're lobbyists and let them know, they typically register right away. So there may be a fee, but typically we don't have any late lobbyist registrations. And finally, political committees and funds. Again, the number of political committees and funds that start to become active in Minnesota and then don't register on time is very, very minimal. So some years, some election cycles, it might be $0 in new fees, and some years it might be a few thousand, but that would be pretty unusual.
Okay. Members, I don't have anyone else on the list that has a question. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question on page 18, line 3. I just need some clarification under putting the disclaimer on. So this is material that is handed out by the candidate, nothing. The language formerly said sent by the candidate, but now it says distributed by the candidate, clearly distributed by the candidate. So does that mean it's me handing these out in an event?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative, the purpose was to make the exception, and this is an exception, it's when the disclaimer is not required, to make the exception broader, so that it wouldn't apply necessarily to things that were just mailed, which was what sent seems to imply, so it could be handed out at a parade or at an event. And Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to address the scope of the disclaimer changes.
All right.
This is in part in response to Representative Carlson's questions. I'd like the committee to keep in mind that these changes to disclaimers, including skywriting and other things, these are all exceptions. They're all things that say you don't have to have a disclaimer in these cases. The way the statute reads right now and the way the board staff has to answer when asked is that technically you have to have a disclaimer on everything, a campaign button, a banner flown over a football field, which has happened, and skywriting. And so the board actually is recognizing that that probably was, in fact, an unintended consequence. It's not really possible or practical to put a disclaimer on everything. And a second unintended consequence is that the disclaimer requirement applies to everybody starting at $1 if you're distributing something in the 7 days before an election. There's an exception beyond that. But if the person on your block wants to distribute something within the week before the election, they would have to have a disclaimer on it. And so this bill also adds thresholds below which it doesn't apply to you at all. And those same those thresholds are the same as would apply to require you to register with a report to the board. So in a typical election resulting involving candidates, it's a $750 threshold below which you don't have to even worry about disclaimers. So what we're doing is attempting to correct an overly broad statute to eliminate a lot of things that people wouldn't expect that they need a disclaimer on, and now the statute will say, yes, you don't have to have the disclaimer.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So distributed is more broad. It could be through the mail as well, and that's still clearly distributed by the candidate.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's correct, good. However they choose to distribute.
Thank you.
And Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, what the skywriting thing just happened to come up, you know, but I did reference, for example, the corporate property and one sign per candidate and all of that. In addition to saying unintended consequences, some of what I was referring to, and this happens in other state agencies as well, is we have to deal periodically with what we sometimes call mission creep. And when you go back to what the original legislative intent may have been, and then over time you have what we sometimes refer to as mission creep, and maybe that's a better way of putting what I was attempting to say when you look at when the law was first passed and where we are today. And there are other circumstances in state government where I could probably point that out as well. I had a bill one time dealing with nursing assistants, and the State Board of Nursing came back with so many rules and regulations that we had in the Health and Human Services bill a hearing, and we told them to go back to the drawing boards, that that was not in any way, shape, or form what the legislative intent was. And I was on the committee, and I happened to have been the author of the bill. So sometimes you encounter over time these kinds of things, and you know, and I don't know how the corporate thing even came forward, but like I say, if you've got a large piece of property and your volunteer who happens to be putting up signs for you, and I'm not in the countryside so I don't have any farms, but if they happen to put up two signs, that's an unintended consequence, but it's also, in my view, an example of mission creep. But that's, I'll just leave it there because we've got other bills on the agenda, and I just want to put up a red flag that let's be careful and keep in mind what the original intent of the board was.
Yes, yep, thank you. And Representative Sanders, closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say this language doesn't say that you can't put more than one sign. The board is saying that one small sign basically doesn't have value, and therefore you wouldn't have to report that sign. But what I will say is if members feel like those couple sections are more convoluted or less clear than current statute, I'm perfectly happy dropping that from the bill. In fact, if you wanted to make the motion in this committee, that would be fine with me as well. We certainly don't want anything in the bill to be unclear. I agree with your spirit, Representative Carlson, of making things simple and keeping things easier, because we do deal with volunteer treasurers and volunteers, and that's how it works at this level. So with that, Madam Chair, I mean, if folks have ideas on how to make the bill simpler, easier now, that's fine. Otherwise, happy to work with members, you know, before we get to the floor to make sure that this is something that everyone can stand behind.
And Representative Sanders, you know, I think we all appreciate the fact that you are carrying this for the Campaign Finance Board. You've done excellent work on it, and we appreciate your time for doing that too. So members, I don't have anyone else that has questions, so I would like to move to a vote on House File 337 going to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill goes to the General Register. Thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Getting in trouble.
Okay. Members, what we're going to do is, as I mentioned earlier, we have some bills that will be coming to us this afternoon. We can't act on them yet because they're not within our possession. So we are going to recess until roughly 30 minutes after session, and we will come back here. Basement. We will be in the basement. I ask for the ease of staff that you take your bills that you have right now and stick them into your folder so that they don't have to do a whole rearrangement. So any of the bills that we haven't heard, please take them now, put them in your folder, and that way staff can just pick up the folders and they will be ready to go for this afternoon, 30 minutes after session. Any bills that we've already heard, you can just set those on the table and they'll have those recycled for you, and that will be taken care of. So with that, members, we are in recess until 30 minutes, approximately 30 minutes after session. So we're going to get ourselves started here. Welcome, Representative Christensen. I am going to move your bill, House File 1725, to the General Register. If you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, this bill authorizes the Office of Administrative Hearings to accept forms filed electronically. Essentially, it allows people to send attachments to emails.
Okay. Members, do you have any questions? Is there anyone, Madam Chair? Representative Nash?
I believe Representative Christensen has a gift for many of you.
Madam Chair, as this is my first bill in front of this committee, the pages have some treats to pass out.
Wow. Thank you, Representative Christensen. As they're handing those out, is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Okay, seeing none, is there anybody that has any questions on this bill? Okay, with that, I renew my motion that House File 1725 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Congratulations. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you for the treats. Okay. Representative Sanders. Representative Lunan, you want to move House File 840?
I'd like to move House File
840.
Oh, my glasses, 840.
To the General Register. Representative Sanders, you want to describe your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the Omnibus Elections Bill. We've had several hearings on the bill, and this bill has several provisions in it. The main one is House File 840, which is the Secretary of State's omnibus bill, if you will. We have House File 1387, which was a Representative Nelson portion of the bill, dealing with political party petitions and giving them a one-year timeline. House File 763, a Nash provision, which allows statutory cities the ability to amend their filing fees. House File 275, which deals, we dealt with this in public safety, but voter registration, crime investigations, and with the county attorneys and law enforcement, and a couple other new provisions in there, as well as Article 2, the military and overseas voting section. And Article 3 is the Uniform Faithful Presidential Electors Act, which was a lush provision. So members, very bipartisan, I would say largely technical and hopefully nonpartisan elections omnibus bill, and we ask for your support.
Okay. And if you can please introduce your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, Julie Strother with the Office of Secretary of State. I'm mostly here to answer questions if there are any.
Great. Is there anybody from the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Okay. Members, questions to the bill? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to move the A150349 amendment.
Can you please describe?
Madam Chair and committee members, what this does is it adds to the individuals not qualified to be an election judge. It also includes now is domiciled either permanently or temporarily with any candidate on the ballot at that election. So what this does is, for similarly, if you're married, if you're cohabitating for a long period of time, it also excludes them from being election judges. So it's simple bill, just adds to make sure in today's environment where not everyone's married but they domicile together, that's what the amendment does.
Representative Sanders to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll leave this up to the committee. If the committee is fine with this, that will be fine. I just want to make sure I know, and I'm sorry, I was thinking through this. Representative Pye, I don't know if you dealt with the effective date issue or not. Otherwise, members, if the committee wishes, I'm okay with the amendment.
I did not.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did not. I looked for the effective date. I didn't. There is no effective date on the amendment, so I don't think it alters the effective date. But
Madam Chair,
Mr. Shepherd, do you have any guidance on this?
Madam Chair and members, if there's no effective date and if there's no appropriation in the bill, it'll be effective August 1.
Okay, Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, that was what I was going to ask Mr. Shepherd. That was my understanding. If there's no effective date, August 1 is the default. And discussions we were having about this this morning and during session and just before here is that the person that brought this forward thought it might be just January 1 effective date. And some of the townships, I understand, train their election judges in November and December. And if there was a January 1 effective date, that there might be an issue with they've trained a judge and now they're now disqualified. But on August 1st would give those townships a chance to train their judges knowing that they can't live with a candidate that's on the ballot.
Okay. Members, any questions? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-15 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay, the A-15 amendment has been adopted. Members, any questions to the bill? House File 840. Representative Howe, any further amendments?
Madam Chair, I believe there is, but I don't have it in my packet. So, what I would like to move, Madam Chair, is to amend the bill to remove the repealer, and the repealer section discusses where is it? Which repealer is it? It say the it talks about the 204B.14, where it discusses the precinct boundaries to follow physical features. I believe that this would be better off served in the in the bill that we talk about redistricting rather than put it in this bill. So I would move we take that repealer section out and leave that in the statute.
Okay. Representative Sanders.
Yeah. Ms. Strother will handle that if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Ms. Struthers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee and representative, part of the reason why this is in this provision here, I believe the bill that you're talking about regarding redistricting at the state level that the legislature engages in, that's drawing the district boundary lines, where this is specifically talking about the process for drawing the precinct boundary lines. And this is here, the repealer of the physical boundaries piece in particular was put in at the request of the League of Cities, who can speak to this if you'd like them to. But there are issues currently with precinct boundaries following physical features when school district boundaries don't follow physical features. And so by removing this language, it allows not the modification of legislative districts or other electoral district lines, but just the precinct district lines, so that you don't have two different ballot styles in some cases in one precinct, which has been a problem for certain precincts.
Okay. Members, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in my city, actually, but in my legislative district, when they redistricted last time because of a problem they had prior to the last redistricting where they had school districts that crossed. They had precincts that had two different school districts in it, and there was an issue in the past where at least our city where they had a ballot out, as Ms. Struthers talked about, with two different, whether you're in Robbinsdale School District or Osceola School District, some people got the wrong ballot and voted on a ballot provision in a school district they didn't live in. And again, so when they redistrict this last time, they divided the districts or the precincts, so you got one's Osceola and one's Anoka, or excuse me, on my district, Osceola and Robbinsdale, but part of Brooklyn Park, it's Osceola and Anoka, and they got them divided, so they're voting in separate places, so that can't happen again. So I would think the Secretary of State's office explanation for why they leave taking this out is a good idea.
And Ms. Struthers, why is it, though, that they're removing the section that's dealing with the census and having the census blocks part of the process?
Madam Chair, it's a slightly different issue, but there are still issues with the census block lines not matching either the municipal boundary lines that are given to the census. They're supposed to match up, and I believe that they do annual communication with the municipalities to get their municipal district lines, but they're not always exactly correct. And I did talk to our GIS person who works with the municipalities on their precinct lines, and he showed me some examples of where the census block line was supposed to be following, for example, a telephone pole line, but it wasn't, and so the legislative district line didn't match up with the census block line or the school district line, and there were similar issues where they had to make corrections.
And Ms. Struthers, has the GIS folks, have they reached out to the U.S. Census Bureau to ask about these questions and see if they will change the census block lines from that perspective?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am not certain if they've reached out proactively. I know that there was an issue in the last redistricting when they tried to get school district lines and the census just wasn't able to get the most accurate and up-to-date school district lines. I believe it was the school districts. And so I think the census has very, though there was a cut and I think they missed 1 year, but has been very proactive in trying to get this information, but it's just not always perfect. And I don't know the process of, for example, our Secretary of State GIS person asking the census to change their census block lines once they're already in place and been used to collect the census data.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Carlson.
Just to follow up what Representative Nelson was saying, years ago I had a precinct split between two school districts. Fortunately, to our knowledge, we didn't have any difficulty with the ballots, but they were split. It was complicated, and now I have another one years later, a different precinct in a different community, but so it still happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Members, I'm going to speak in favor of the amendment to remove this section from the bill. I think that there's other avenues that could have been pursued by the individuals that are involved with this, and so I'd speak in favor of that. I'm going to have Representative Howe is going to renew his motion to remove the repealer section 204B.14. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The section is removed. Representative Sanders, to your bill.
It's a good bill, members. Please support it.
Members, Representative Lunan renews his motion for House File 841-840 to be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And the bill is passed. Members, we have Representative Lunan's bill, House File 1538. Representative Nash, you want to move the bill?
I would move House File 1538 to the General Register.
Correct. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a what I consider a non-controversial bill. This is a situation where, in work comp cases, where we tap into the resources of a retired judge to come in and fill in. They would not be replacing a active employee. This would only be for situations where we're going to have difficulty getting to someone to come in and cover, and it will allow us to
satisfy the legal proceeding in a timely manner for the victim and all parties involved. And it allows us to tap into the expertise that the retired judges already possess. They, it's pretty straightforward. That's about it. I'm going to let my testifier also speak on that matter.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tammy Poost, and I'm the Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And Representative Lunan has well described the bill, so I'll just stand for any questions you may have.
Members, any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I asked this in the previous committee when it was heard, and I just want to get it again on the record. We're not using this provision to eliminate having to appoint new workers' compensation judges. I believe in the previous committee it was mentioned that there's a large group of people hitting retirement age, and but we're not going to be using this as a way to not have to hire new workers' compensation judges.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson. In the bill itself, it states the criteria when we would evoke this, and it's when there's a conflict of interest or if for some reason they aren't able to obtain a judge. Actually, if judges retired and they weren't replaced yet, it might increase the likelihood of that occurring, but it would be this law is intended for a case-by-case basis to keep things moving in a timely manner.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, is there any other questions? Is there anybody from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Representative Nash renews his motion that House File 1538 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right.
Good at this.
Thank you. Representative Howe. Representative Howe, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 745 to go to the General Registry.
Okay. To your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this is a bill I've been working on the last couple of years, and I believe that you'll hear some opposition to this bill, but I think we're going to – there's a lot of issues with the Veterans Preference Act, and we've identified some of them. We could take an omnibus bill, and it'd take for quite a bit to do that, just to get the Veterans Preference Bill in order. So, but this is just one piece of it that we believe that needs to be done now. And currently, a veteran that's been notified for discharge has a right to a veterans hearing. The problem with the current structure is that once you get your notice of discharge, and you, if the city or the county has a civil service board or a county personnel board, the veteran has no choice but to go through that board if he wants a veterans, if the veteran wants a hearing. Keep in mind, those boards and commissions are appointed by the very entity that's got him up for got the veteran up for discharge. So what we're trying to do is make this a more fair process and give the veteran a fair hearing. So this bill actually does three things. It gives the veteran a choice between the civil service board or the county personnel board or the current structure in the law that's a three-member panel. The second thing it does is currently teachers are not allowed to use this process, and I firmly believe after I just last year had a teacher that wasn't afforded this opportunity, I firmly believe it doesn't really make any difference if you're a snowplow driver or a teacher. If you're a veteran, you should have this process available to you. The third thing it does is it provides, as you'll hear currently, The current provision does not provide who pays for the veterans hearing, even though it's been fairly understood that the governmental agency the employer pays for it. Currently, there is nothing in statute that indicates that. This would indicate that the government employee pays for the veteran's hearing. It also provides that if the veteran is held harmless and retains his position or their position, that the governmental agency will pay for the veteran's reasonable attorney's fees. Because the government employer starts this process, we believe that if the veteran prevails, they should be held harmless. And to that point, Madam Chair, I'd like to have my testifier speak to his experience through this process.
If you can please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Chris Stroner. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Howell, and if there are any veterans in the audience today, thank you for the opportunity to address you on this important issue. My name is Chris Stroner. I've been a police officer in the state of Minnesota since January 11th, 1993. My intent here is not to disparage my current employer, but to tell you my story. I know you've all had a long day, and my time here is short, so we'll attempt to condense the last 3 years of my life into a couple of minutes. As a young boy, I knew I wanted to be a soldier. I joined the Army when I was 17 and served on active duty after I graduated from high school. Once I left active duty, I came back to the state of Minnesota and began a career in law enforcement, but I always felt I had more to give to the military. So in January of 2000, I joined the Minnesota Army National Guard, and in December of 2000, I deployed to Saudi Arabia with my unit for the first time. As everyone here knows, September 11th, 2001 changed everything, and after that, four more mobilizations and deployments would follow. I spent nearly six of the last 14 years mobilized and deployed overseas as an infantryman, and nearly two and a half of those years in direct combat. I returned to Minnesota from my last year-long deployment on May 1st, 2012. On May 3rd, I dropped my then two-year-old daughter off at daycare, and I stopped by my police department to say hello. I found out that my access card had been turned off, and there was a note waiting for me in the dispatch office stating that I had been placed on administrative leave while an outside agency conducted an investigation to a situation that occurred in 2010, nearly 2 years prior to that, while I was assigned as the detective sergeant for my police department. I called the police chief to discuss the situation, and in the course of that conversation, he told me that he believed it would all be wrapped up by the end of next week. Now, mind you, that was the beginning of May 2012. At the end of May 2012, the outside agency finished its investigation and determined that there was no wrongdoing. Their investigation was reviewed by two separate prosecuting agencies who also concurred with their findings. My police administration did not like the findings of those three independent agencies and decided they were going to do another investigation themselves. At the end of June 2012, I learned that my administrative leave was in unpaid status in violation of both the law and our collective bargaining agreement, and I had to get my union involved. After working unsuccessfully with my union to resolve the issue, I was finally told by them that I should get a military lawyer involved. And I truly was all alone. I had to hire a private attorney, and by the grace of God, I found one that really does care about veterans. By January of 2013, the back pay issue was unresolved, and I was forced to file a civil lawsuit against the city and the chief of police. 2 days after they were served, the city delivered an intent to terminate notice to me at my house, and they sent another veteran to deliver it. The request was given a Loudermill hearing, and the city subsequently reaffirmed their intent to terminate me, again sending that same veteran to deliver it. I chose to appeal the termination in front of a three-member panel, as is laid out in current law, as would be laid out in this bill. A hearing was held over a series of 11 days in June, July, and August of 2013. The city took 8.5 days to present its case, and I took 2.5 days to refute it. In October of 2013, the panel unanimously reversed the termination decision, and I was ultimately returned to duty in December of 2013. After the decision in October of 2013, I had a meeting with the chief of police and the operations captain to discuss moving forward after the investigation and hearing. was told I was a valuable member of the department. I'd been there over 20 years, and I had a lot to offer. I left that meeting feeling like, as an organization, we'd be able to move forward. The next day, there was a knock at my door. When I opened it, I was served with a lawsuit for $66,525.14, the cost of my selected arbitrator and half the cost of the neutral arbitrator. The case was heard in district court in December of 2013, and the city's case was dismissed in January of 2014. The city filed for reconsideration, and the district court refused that request. I can tell you it's a painful experience on many levels to have to take vacation from a job you worked at over 20 years, to go to court and defend yourself from a lawsuit that the city filed against you, or to get your paycheck every other week and realize it won't cover a quarter of your monthly legal fees. In March of 2014, the city filed an appeal with the State Court of Appeals, and the case was heard in front of that court in October of 2014. The Court of Appeals upheld the dismissal of the city's suit in November of 2014, and it's my understanding that the two arbitrators were finally paid in December of 2014 and January of 2015, just 2 months ago. And that's the Reader's Digest version of why I'm here for you today. To date, I spent nearly $41,000 on attorney's fees defending myself and fighting the city's lawsuit, and that's at a much discounted veterans rate. And I still have the possibility of a nearly $67,000 bill hanging over my head. I watched testimony on Representative Howell's bill in front of the Veterans Committee last year. It was clear that every member of that committee understood the spirit of the law was that the employer pays for it. But the law as it currently stands does not specifically say that, and it leaves enough ambiguity to allow an employer to leverage their vast resources and financial assets against that of a lone veteran. Last year, there was testimony that the change in law was not needed because it didn't affect thousands or tens of thousands of veterans. This issue, thankfully, does not affect thousands or tens of thousands of veterans because most employers understand and comply with the law. And most bad employees never use this process. They take a buyout and leave, resign. But it does affect some veterans, and those are the ones that need the protection. As you can imagine, it's not easy for veterans to come forward and ask for help, particularly those in the public safety sector. But I'm here with my hand up telling you right now, we need this help. This bill comes too late to help me. What's done is done. But if this bill can be the good that comes out of my experience, then I can accept that and I can live with that. This bill will not prevent employers from firing veterans for incompetency or misconduct. And it really won't even level the playing field, but it'll at least give the veterans a fighting chance. We'll ensure that veterans who choose the honorable work of educating our children receive the same rights as those who decide to be firefighters or police officers or mechanic at a public works department. We'll ensure that a veteran's case will be heard in front of an unbiased panel, not handpicked by the same employer that's trying to fire them. And most importantly, we'll ensure that a veteran does not have to choose between exercising their constitutionally protected rights or paying their mortgage or sending their children to college. I urge you to support HF 745. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Droner. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgart, and I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. As Representative House stated, the veterans preference statutes are very complicated and inconsistent, and I just wanted to come up here very quickly before I defer to my colleague from Polk County to thank Representative Howe for reaching out to local units of government and for his willingness to discuss these emotional and oftentimes uncomfortable issues on behalf of both the employer and employee. We've expressed concerns to the author about the bill in its current form, but are looking forward to continuing the discussions on how to make the veterans preference statutes more clear, consistent, and helpful for both employers and veterans. And with that, if there aren't any questions, I would defer to my colleague county coordinator from Pope County.
Mr. Thurene, it is?
Yes, it is.
If you can please state your name for the record.
I am Jim Thurene, the Pope County, that's T-H-O-R-E-E-N. Okay. My Swedish father would appreciate that. I'm currently serving as the Pope County, Minnesota coordinator. I have served in like capacities in three other Minnesota counties, and I've served 1.5 terms as the elected Beltrami County auditor at Bemidji. I'm an honorably discharged U.S. Army veteran, having served our country for 2 years as an instructor in the Pershing Guided Missile System at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, following my basic training in 1968. Thank you for this opportunity to share perspectives regarding House File 745, particularly those sections of the bill which expand the rights of a veteran to as to choice of remedy in circumstances arising from a local unit of government decision to discharge a veteran, a process I have experienced. I characterize it as a circumstance which is uncomfortable, unlikable, and unfortunate for both the veteran and the local government unit. Again, such circumstances in my 40 years of experience in local government are fortunately rare. However, discharge is a last resort action derived from careful overview of a veteran's performance and documentation of that performance, coupled with, if applicable, any deceptive practices by said veteran. The county or city does not take lightly discharge of any employee, but unfortunately is in a necessary step in progressive disciplinary action to ensure consistency in human resources practices, labor contracts, compliance with law, rules, and regulations, or with local policy. Before I offer precise comments regarding House File 745, permit me to offer a brief description of a typical discharge process in county government. The county, upon hiring a veteran, does so with the knowledge that only extraordinary circumstances will permit a discharge of that individual. Acceptable and above average performance essentially guarantees a veteran a job for his or her life unless he or she is convicted of a qualifying crime or specifically egregious behavior. But non-performance of the job documented through proper supervisory oversight and brought to the attention of the veteran through progressive discipline may lead the county to the conclusion that discharge is the suitable last resort. Presently, upon legal guidance from the county attorney or our labor law attorney, we can move to discharge and place the veteran in a paid status as required by Minnesota Statute 197.46. The veteran has up to 60 days to determine if he or she will file for a hearing. A tenured teacher, by contrast, must decide whether to request a hearing regarding termination of employment within 14 days. If the veteran chooses to file for a hearing, the county continues to pay the veteran's salary and his or her fringe benefits until the hearing is conducted and a decision is reached. Typically, this translates into a 5 to 6 month period of paid time away from the job. The uncertainty of the outcome will not permit the county to hire a replacement worker. It is not unusual that a monetary settlement is negotiated so that the veteran does not return to a workplace in which he or she or other workers find to be at best uncomfortable. In some instances, individuals who have engaged in serious misconduct resign on the day of the hearing, having received full pay and benefits until that time. Monetarily, such circumstances cost the county tens of thousands of dollars in staff time, payment to labor law attorneys to represent the county, lost productive time in the veterans department in the county, and salary and fringe benefits paid to an individual for non-production. Even without the additional cost proposed by the new legislation, the taxpayer is bearing a significant cost. The concerns I relayed to the committee today focus on the additional costs and county's belief that we should be adding more incentives to encourage the hiring of veterans, not the other way around. Section E, as provided in the bill, added could result in more cost to the governing body already borne by the local taxpayer. The county is not required to pay the attorney's fees for other public employees for termination proceedings, and there is no compelling reason to treat these employees differently, particularly when they are being paid during the pendency of the proceedings. In short, neither Minnesota County government nor I want to dishonor any veteran who joins the proud ranks of public servants. We take our lawful responsibility to uphold fair and reasonable employment laws. We conform to union contracts and county government policies, and we strive to hire the most qualified applicant. What we ask for is consistency and fairness in regards to our other employees. This alone, in my opinion, will do much to benefit the ultimate goal, which is to encourage the hiring of veterans in our local units of government. I thank you for the opportunity. I will stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howe, you and I share a strong and abiding belief in the support of veterans, and you know full well that I would never want to undermine any efforts to support those that come back after serving our country. But I do want to just maybe delve into the question of the circumstances prevailing in one regard with Mr. Stroner. And I want to be certainly appreciative of issues of confidentiality. But my first question, Representative Howe, is to the point that the delay in the request for hearing being 2 years, it was vague to me in terms of, is that not part of the current statute? Delaying filing a complaint against an individual, why did it take 2 years?
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, there is no, there's nothing in the law that dictates what is the time frame for filing that type of a complaint. That is bared on, I suppose, the contract, and however that works. I mean, they could add I don't really have a problem with the 2 year delay to the point where if they tried to offer. Try to do something with disciplinary tactics or training or something to appease that, whatever that infraction, and I'm not talking about Officer Strainer here, I'm just talking about a hypothetical situation where you've got an employee that does something wrong, you go through a period of time to try to get them to do the right thing and operate correctly. And that's my point, before we get to this stage, you should have done some disciplinary, you should have done retraining, you should have some steps that are well documented. I think the county and the cities would agree that should be a process that's well documented well before you get to this stage of the game. So this action should be very, very rare, but why a 2 year delay? I would assume and part of this is because of the deployment process, and there's probably I would say that he was probably deployed during some of that time that caused some of this delay, but that's only my supposition. That's a guess on mine. Maybe Mr. Strainer could answer that for you.
Mr. Strainer?
Madam Chair, Representative, are you specifically asking about the 2010 to the start of the investigation in 2012, or are you talking about the start of the investigation in 2012 to the actual hearing the notice to terminate in 2013?
Madam Representative Chair. Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your testimony, I don't want to, and you can clarify for me, I heard that you returned from active duty from deployment, went to your police office, kind of checked in, and then just shortly after that, you received a notice of a complaint from an action that was before an action based upon activity that occurred 2 years prior. And so my question goes to, was that during a deployment where, in a sense, they could not deliver that complaint earlier to you, or why? What were the circumstances prevailing around the delay in you receiving the complaint from that supposed action?
Mr. Strainer.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. The situation occurred because between 2010, and yes, I was deployed, but that wasn't the reason. And when I returned in 2012, we had we'd hired a new police chief, and there was a new party promoted to captain. And so they learned about the situation involves the sale of some property that the police department was auctioning off. And so they learned about the sale in 2012, and well, we're surprised because they didn't know about it, which is not a surprise because the chief of police didn't even work there when this happened. The former chief of police, city finance, were all well aware of it. It was all well documented. So they thought there was something going on there, so they decided to look into it. In fact, I was home on leave in December of 2011, and I spoke to the new police chief specifically about it, and he had talked to some other people, so don't worry about it. But apparently they changed their mind between then and the middle of 2012.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for my own edification, from the standpoint of as the legislation is drafted now by Representative Howell, would you believe that you would have received a more thorough vetting of the issue with that platform as opposed to those already in statute? What would be the difference between what is already in statute in terms for hearing a grievance and what changes there are under what is here?
Mr. Strainer.
What the difference is?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, my city made a concerted effort to dismantle their civil service commission about 10 years ago because they felt it was an impediment to the hiring process. It slowed things down. At the time, they guaranteed all the city unions there wouldn't be any loss of rights and this and that. Had they not done that, I would have been forced to have my veterans preference hearing in front of that hand-selected civil service commission. But because they chose to get rid of that, I was able to go through the three-member panels laid out in the law in case there isn't a civil service commission established, if that answers your question.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it typical, and maybe Representative Howe can answer this, but is it typical for a municipality to dismantle that type of a council?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I think that you'll see more and more cities go that route, but some have very well, they have very good acting, or they like the civil service commissions and their personnel boards. Some are transitioning away from that. It just that depends on the city government and what they prefer, I guess. I've seen some. I've worked for two city governments that both had civil service panels, and I've worked for one that does not. So yeah, that I think is. I don't know if the county commissioner or the county administrator would like to speak to that.
But Mr. Thrain.
Madam Chair and Representative, in Polk County, we do not have a civil service commission. We have not adopted the Minnesota County Government Personnel Act, and thus the only remedy for a veteran in our case is to the three-member hearing panel.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
The other avenue that most employees take in these situations, because most of these employees are belong to a union, and most of them choose the union route for grievances and fixture on that because they're the union. That's a union attorney. They don't have it reduces the veterans' cost a great deal by going through the union arbitration process rather than coming to this route. The reason that you see veterans coming this route is usually because in my own case, when I had to go through some of this, it was my union said, I got 50 other folks to worry about before I worry about you. And so I hired my own attorney. And I'm sure that that's it, kind of what Mr. Strainer had, and that's why I did something with the school teacher and took the school teacher prohibition out, because I had a school teacher last year from Eden Valley Watkins that contacted me through that. So that, and that's just three cases. I don't know how many more, but and it's not right. And then people say, well, you should be doing something about that. And I'm going, you know what? It's tough enough when you're fighting these things to do, and without creating more hate and discontent. It's, you know, you're just trying to survive when you're going through this.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the County Administrator, just to follow up in terms of, you mentioned that you did not adopt the civil servant program. Was there, what was the reasoning behind that?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Thrain.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I have worked in five Minnesota counties. None of them in the time I've been in county government have had a civil service board. There is another option in law, which is the Minnesota County Personnel Act. And for those counties that adopt that act, they do have an opportunity to form a different approach for veterans. And I can't tell you how many counties have adopted it. I've not worked under it, so I don't know. But in Pope County, my current employer, we have solely the approach of that of a three-member hearing panel.
Representative Albright.
No further questions, Madam.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get a sense of how big or how wide the problem. I guess you said three cases there earlier. So has there been, how many complaints have there been about the Civil Service Commission about veterans being treated unfairly? I just want to get some idea so we're not just going based on one person's unfortunate story.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson. I guess I would have had to, I should have went back to my emails a year ago because that's when my email lit up on this. And I'm not saying there's hundreds of them. I don't believe that. And we really don't know, because most of these cases never get to this point. Most of them don't go through a three-member panel. Many of them have a civil service board. Many of them use the union arbitration process. So when we talk about these, they're relatively few. I talking to the Department of Veterans Affairs, they handle probably a half a dozen of these a year. So I don't think it's a huge problem, but when you're dealing when you're the veteran that's going through it, it doesn't make any difference how many other there's like you. It's just that I don't believe any veteran should have to go through this process.
Representative Johnson.
Was the county administrator, were you going to say something? Thank you, Madam Chair. Or no?
No.
Okay, Mr. that's good. That's enough for me. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Well, no. Madam Chairman, first of all, I understand the witness said that referred to the fact that if it's good enough for police and fire, it should be good enough for other people. And I gather some local governments have civil service commissions that are only for police and fire. And that's, I think, examples of Brainerd, Richfield, Rochester, St. Louis Park, and Wilmer. And so one of the things that we might think about doing is requiring anyone that has a civil service commission that's only open to certain parts of the government hear complaints from all parts. But there are various local governments have, and that's the ones that I have listed of Minneapolis, Wyndham, St. Paul, St. Louis County, and they have established civil service commissions that have been used to conduct appeal hearings for discharged employees, including veterans. And I understand, now I don't pretend to do this from personal knowledge, that the existing system in Minneapolis has been fair and impartial to all employees, including qualified military veterans, that the hearings occur in a timely and efficient manner under the current system. And so I'm interested, one, and in Minneapolis, at least, the current Civil Service Commission rules have been in existence since 1913. So an example, I'd like to know if in those cities that I've named, which have civil service commissions, do we have any complaints specifically from those cities?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I believe you said Minneapolis.
Yes.
Rochester and Wilmer.
Minneapolis. No, I said Rochester and Wilmer have them only for police and fire. I said the complete ones are, that I know of are in Minneapolis, Windham, St. Paul, St. Louis County.
Representative Howe.
Mm-hmm. So thank you, Madam Chair.
In other words, if you have...
I believe St. Cloud is also would fit into that.
Yes, I said St. Paul on that one.
St. Cloud. But anyway,
well, I don't,
that's
I
beside
don't know.
The point. I did hear complaints from some folks from St. Paul. But I will tell you that when I first started this venture, I actually eliminated the whole board and went to the Office of Administrative Hearings. I will tell you that that was not a popular thing, and I learned a great deal from that exercise, because I did have veterans that wanted to use the Civil Service Board. So that's why it's an option. I did not remove it. I put the board process back in. And I left it, so it's an option for the veteran. Wherever they feel that they're going to get a balanced, fair hearing, it's their choice which process they choose. Because I heard from both sides on that issue.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, the problem is that moving some or all of these veterans' hearings to an external panel will increase costs to the city. The city will have to pay the administrative costs of holding the hearing, including compensation, travel expenses for the three-person panel, when they already have a system in place for doing it. So I just wondered that why existing organizations that have long-established systems in place and seem to be providing a fair and impartial hearing to all employees, including qualified military veterans, need to allow access to yet another system that adds new lawyers and processes. I thought you guys are against more government. And has the potential to increase costs and give a longer, more drawn-out process. And I wondered if we could be thinking about something that allowed, instead of setting up a whole new process, for the cities that have existing civil service commissions, allowed some kind of appeals process or something like that. I don't know if they have an appeal, but an appeals process that would move to something else. So what?
Madam Chair.
You know, if there isn't a problem, and I'm not pretending that I know this subject, why change it?
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I wouldn't have brought it if there wasn't a problem. And I'm not, and the reason there's an option is because there are some that actually work. But to sit here and pick and choose which ones work for a certain employee, you know, that's a real roll of the dice when you're trying to figure it out. So I'm not. That's why we didn't take it away. We made it an option, and we're not creating anything new. We left the current process in place, and so both of the options that are there are both currently in place. We created no new options, no new process, because I went down the road of creating a new process and realized that wasn't palatable for very many folks. The only support I really got was, I think I got a little support from a couple of veterans, and the Officer of Administrative Hearings were the only ones that liked that process. So I quickly discarded that, and we opted for this process. The reason is we go down this road is because I had other testifiers that went through a civil service board operation, got ridiculed and demeaned through the process. And that's, I guess, why I'm not going to sit here and go through the state and try to dictate and figure out who's got a good civil service board and who's got a bad civil service board. I just figure that, and we've received a lot of support from the veterans organizations, that giving the veteran the option is a fair choice. If the veteran feels that the city's got a good civil service board that's impartial, they'll get a fair hearing, that's where they go. And that's not a problem. It saves it. It's a faster process. But you'll find that most employees are in a union and take the union route. It's very rare that we end up with union employees going through this process.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, that's kind of my problem, is setting up a whole new process when we have no idea how many people would want to use it. And I'm not sure I like the idea of someone picking and choosing between different processes which are supposed to be fair and equal. I mean, you can't kind of, you don't have that, you can't kind of switch your judge if you're before a judge just because you think there's another better judge. So.
Okay. Mr. Thurene?
Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to clarify, my experience is limited to county government, so I don't know the ins and outs of city government operations, civil service board. I can offer to you my perspective that, and I've just tried to recollect in my time period in county government, I think three times I've gone to a veterans discharge hearing. And actually, in each case, the veteran had the option to go to the union through their labor contract and chose not to, because the labor contract would not have been as beneficial to the veteran in pay. Under the Veterans Preference Act, as I mentioned in the testimony, a veteran has 60 days in which to apply for a hearing, and during that time we pay all costs. And upon filing for the hearing, we again continue to pay all costs. And I can't speak to labor contracts specifically, but I believe that would probably not be the case under a labor contract.
Okay. Representative Conania?
Well, this, you know, I just have problems with this bill because of that. Because I don't think that the problem, you know, I don't think we need a new law and a new process because of one or two stories. I think we need to have some study as to where the stories come from. Are there specific problems we can identify throughout the state and deal with those instead of, you know, I guess my complaint, I've heard my complaint from the city, my complaint against the bills come from the city of Minneapolis. And I don't know if there are complaints about the process in the city of Minneapolis, but if there are, I'd certainly like to know that. And I'd much prefer a system that, you know, kept the system in place instead of started with the totally new expenses of a totally new system and then figured out some route of appeal from that system gives what someone thinks is an unjust result. Okay. That would make me much more comfortable than this bill that really sort of starts all over again.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have an unfortunate distinction of actually having gone through this as an elected official. In 2009, I was a city councilman, and we did have a progressive discipline issue where we had to let someone go. We had documented progressive discipline, and he was a veteran, and he filed for his veteran's preference appeal. We were coached at the time, both by the league, and I see the league is here, that this was how the process was designed. The process worked well, and they kind of gave us some historical background on that. Everything that I've heard about this says that this is an aberration to the process, that this is so far outside of it, and I think that because of that, I would support this, because I don't feel that this has been done properly, and that if you've not been given really a fair shake in the process, that there's got to be some way to ameliorate that process. So I'm in favor of this bill, because I, having lived through it, and we were on TV, we had, when you roll into city government and you've got five news trucks out front, you know it's going to be a bad night. We had a bad night for several months. It's a hot and contentious issue. This one strikes me as something that is so far outside of what we were coached through the LMCIT folks and our own attorney that it strikes me as something that needs a remedy, and I support this.
Yeah. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I have a statement, and then I want a question. I want to revert to the honor and remember flag this morning when I was grumping about that. It was not the symbolism of a flag honoring those that have lost their lives in service that I was upset about. It was the flag design. I don't think I've ever seen anything. Anyway, I apologize if you misunderstood that. My question is, in this bill, does this interfere with discharge of a teacher? There's school districts in here, and does that mean teachers also are subject to this?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Earhart, this would be an option for the teacher, the veteran that's employed as a teacher. This would now become an option for that teacher to use this process.
Well,
Representative
Earhart. Madam Chair, we're having a big struggle with how we're discharging teachers at the present time. It seems to me that I've heard hours of of everybody saying, giving their views on it not too long, too many nights ago. Now, how does this cut with what we've got in here? Does it throw all of that stuff out and we go to this if that's the preference of the teacher that's being discharged or trying to be discharged or something?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Earhart, if the teacher preparing to be discharged is a veteran, they could appeal to this process and have a veterans hearing. The rest of that, and basically where this would be for is for discharge. I don't know how it would play into that other piece, but this has nothing to do, I don't believe, with a reduction in staffing. This would be a firing for disciplinary action.
Well,
Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I have the impression that there is also that in statute now for teachers that they can be, it's not only longevity that counts, but it's also disciplinary for certain things. And how do we, who decides the person that they're putting the screws to gets to decide whether he wants to do veterans or go with the negotiated,
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say this gives the veteran the choice.
Well, Madam Chair, does everybody who's doing the teachers trying to streamline the teachers' process for exiting, are they aware of this? I think you ought to bring this to their attention. I think this probably has bearing on some of the stuff that's in motion to streamline the discharge of teachers. That's all.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a former labor representative and having had to deal with this from the from the union side as opposed to the employer side that Representative Nash talked about, most times when you get into these situations, when the employer does their proper documentation, as Mr. Farine pointed out, you can get rid of anybody. You can get rid of Jesus Christ if you do document him properly.
Having
worked in the public sector before I became a labor representative, I worked for an manager that had took inordinate pleasure out of firing people, and he would go out of his way to pick an employee and hound them for whatever reason until he was able to either the person quit out of frustration or he found a way to fire them. And if he picked out an individual, and that person would get lucky if somebody else really messed up and so he would divert his attention to that other individual, and that person that he was going after the first time got off the hook. I think, and so the public employers, unlike what a lot of people believe, can get rid of union employees if they do their job. And I see Mr. Thurin shaking his head. But with that, in a normal situation when a union goes to arbitration, labor pays their half, the management pays their half, and they go through the arbitration process. I think the egregious part here that we're trying to fix here is the, and I think that's what a lot of the discussion here has been about, is the on 3.4 section E, that this would, if the veteran prevails in the situation that was described by Officer Stoner, is it Stoner? Or
Stroner,
okay. That they then turned around. They went through the process. They went through the investigation. They had the investigation. This is from what I've heard, the two times I've heard this. They went through the investigation. They lost. I mean, they said, no, you won't have any basis to stand on, but they went ahead and proceeded with termination anyway without proper documentation. Went to court and lost an appeal, lost another appeal, and almost out of spite, and I'm going to say it that way, it almost out of spite, it looks like they turned around, and we're going to get him back and sue him to make him pay for it. I don't think anybody envisioned that that's the way that it should happen. I think if there was just cause there and they went after it, and he prevailed in a union process, that the union would pay the half that they had in the city, or the employer would pay their half, and everyone would go forward. So I mean, this, because this, and to the point that was made earlier about the union said go the veterans route. Sometimes as a business agent for a union, you make a decision. You might have a better shot of winning and getting a better outcome if you go the veterans route than you go through the union contract. So those are sometimes decisions that are made in the process going forward. So that's kind of how it works. And I think this, we heard this bill last year or the year before, but we heard this in the last session. We passed it out of this house on the last session. I don't remember, did it pass on the floor? And I guess that's a question. It was on the general register. So we passed out of the committee last year. It ended up not getting passed, going ahead. But I think this is a good bill. I think it would solve the situation. I think it would make city governments think twice about being vindictively in there. And there are, just like in any other employment situation, there are bad employers and there are bad managers that sometimes get in their head, they decide this is going to happen, and they push their way through, and it may be the wrong thing to do. But this would, I think, give some pause to have the government agencies, if the veteran chose this route, to prevent it from happening, from prevent them being punished. And so, Madam Chair, I believe this is, we should pass this bill and have it go forward, and we can have a full discussion on the House floor.
Representative Lunin.
I'm going to pass. I'm just going to vote for it.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess a question to Representative Nash, which is, did your city have a civil service commission?
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to yield for a question. Yes, we did not have one. We were a small city, and the city council was, we had a hearing. And we were represented by both the league and by our own lawyer, and we did not have a civil service panel.
Representative Kahn.
Again, as I said, my not quite an objection, but my question about this bill is, why would one interfere with the cities that have operative civil service commissions and make them go into a new process of unknown costs and unknown results? And particularly if there haven't been complaints from those civil service commissions. I just, I don't object to making this as an alternative someplace where it's needed. But I do object to putting it in where, forcing it in over something that's been working, okay, even if it's just added as an additional alternative.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
You know, I've been listening, and I very much appreciate the comments made by Representative Nash. I think that brought some clarity to some of the concerns that and the observations that I had. But as I've also remarked on the normative legal process, when you are standing before a judge with accusations, you as the defendant do have the opportunity to choose either a jury trial or of your peers, or in the context of having the judge hear it by himself. And I think in the context that Representative Howe has prepared this, what it does is it gives the veteran the same level playing field as anyone in the normative community process would provide. So in the context that avails a veteran of another tool that he can avail himself to defend himself equitably and fairly in a machine that might otherwise not be entirely observant of what he's trying to do and be challenged by, either monetary or otherwise, I think this would be a good motive to move forward on. So I would be in support of this bill.
Okay. Well, we're going to have last call from anyone from the public that wishes to testify to this bill. If you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Sure. My name is Ann Lindstrom with the League of Minnesota Cities, and you've had a very robust discussion and covered a lot of it, so I will be very brief. I wanted to thank Representative Howe for the conversations that we've had. We have been working on this for 2 years, and I would say that the cities want the omnibus bill, and I've told that to Representative Howe, to improve the entire process from beginning, middle, and end when it comes to veteran hiring, retention, and dealing with termination on behalf of the cities and the counties. But I understand that Representative Howe is extremely passionate about fixing the situation that we heard tonight, as are we. When the bill left committee and went to the General Register last session, the language still allowed for the choice between a civil service commission and a three-person panel, and it clarified that political subdivisions would pay all costs except for the veterans' attorney's fees. And at that time, we were supportive of that language because it was clear and it delineated, so it would prevent the situation that you heard tonight. The city could not turn around and go after the veteran following the case. One of the things that we are interested in working on is consistency between state practices with veterans as well as political subdivisions. Currently, the state can utilize probationary periods upon hiring veterans. Political subdivisions cannot. So that's one of the issues that Representative Howe has said he is interested in working with us on, and has indicated that we could even potentially look at language before the bill gets to the House floor. Our cities that have civil service commissions will continue to be very concerned about the choice because, as Representative Kahn said, we don't hear a lot about the situations that go well. We just hear about the situations that go very poorly. And the civil service commissions that are efficient, cost-effective, and have established people who have dealt with many of these types of situations are a valuable resource to those political subdivisions. So those cities will continue to have those concerns. But we will keep working with Representative Howe, especially before it gets to the bill, and hopefully come up with something that is benefiting all the parties, veterans, employers, et cetera.
Okay. Representative Nash, Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, and I can tell from the tone of your voice I should probably hurry up, so I will. I want to stress again, this is for those circumstances that don't go well. Again, the league coached us very, very well when we went through this, and this is a pathway for when, and I think it is an aberration, when cities don't get it right. And I'm a passionate former mayor, and I believe in how city government should work. This one seems to have not worked well. And there was no alternative, and I appreciate the fact that we have this bill before us. Representative Howe, thanks for doing that. And my last point is, I think this is the first time in committee that Representative Nelson and I have agreed on something.
All right, Mr. Thrien.
Madam Chair, if I may, just a moment. Thank you for the consideration. And again, as Mr. Hilgard indicated, we do want to continue to work with Representative Howe on this bill. Neither AMC nor I are in opposition to this legislation. We do have some things we do need to work on, and Representative Howe has been very gracious in that. And one other comment that Mr. Hilgart may not appreciate, but in my position as a county coordinator, I am not subject to this veterans preference. Yeah. So I don't have a dog in the hunt, so to speak.
Okay, great. Representative Howe, last word.
Thank you,
or you
Madam
don't
Chair.
Have to have one either.
I will tell you that I appreciate all the comments and the discussion. This has been a long process, and I will say it's a very emotional thing for me and for Mr. Stroner, and I appreciate your support.
Okay. Members, with that, we are Representative Howe renews his motion that House File 745 will be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, the House File 745 goes to the General Register. Representative Lane. Representative Lane moves for Bill House File 1003 be referred to the General Register. Representative Lane, you want to present your bill?
Thank you, and hopefully we'll go to an easier and later version here, and the actual second engrossment is being passed out now because we just did it in civil law this morning.
Okay.
So my fire chief, who is here, and I applaud his endurance to be able to come at 8:15 this morning with me and now again in the evening to present the same bill.
Oh, shoot. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
So, but he brought this request to me actually last year to allow fire and police to donate equipment that's no longer serviceable to them and has minimal or no resale value. In general, there's no state statute that says a municipality can donate to a nonprofit, and some think this lack of direct permission doesn't apply to things that have no resale value, but most cities just won't go there. So with this statute, then, we will be able to let them do this. There's items that are still usable but are outdated or don't meet current standards, and they just hate to just junk them. So this could be as simple as giving away old cell phones to a domestic abuse shelter. It could also be that a third world country could use it in establishing a fire service. For instance, an old fire hose, which is no longer up to standards here, could have the brass ends cut off and those sold for scrap, or its still serviceable hose could go to a country in West Africa. So I would like to turn it over to my fire chief so that he can tell you a little bit more details here.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Gary Gorman, the fire chief for the City of Columbia Heights. And Representative Lane covered it very, very well. We all have equipment that through the years that gets replaced. Some of it is really still good equipment. It can still be used. A lot of this equipment we do offer some of it to other fire departments. We can sell it to other fire departments. We can donate to other fire departments. But sometimes there's no need for it, or they don't need it, they don't want it, or else it's just a little bit out of standard in America, but it's still good equipment, safe equipment, and still very usable. And there are avenues that by donating it to nonprofit organizations, they can take this equipment to other countries. West Africa is one of them, Mexico, Central America, some of the other countries that fire equipment does go to. And we would just like to have that opportunity to do that instead of just scrapping it out or throwing it away. It's just a nice way to pay forward on equipment that's still very workable.
Right. Members, is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify to this bill? Members, Representative Lunan. No question. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a possibility that some smaller town in the United States might be using some of this equipment rather than shipping it to South America or somewhere? I mean, you know, you got a truck that you have, I think is no longer serviceable, but you got a big town there, and maybe somebody else in somewhere in this country or the state could use it.
Yep. Chief Gorman?
It is, and it can be. And actually, fire trucks themselves, we see get sold to all over the country. They get advertised more because they're actually in a fire truck that's 20 years old, 30 years old. There's still a lot of good use out of that, and they do have a high value. So we do see fire trucks being sold out of state many times and stay in the country. It's a lot more difficult to bring a fire truck to West Africa as opposed to small equipment. And I think that's probably one of the biggest reasons, just to ship it someplace is very difficult to do.
Representative Earhart?
No, I just meant, Madam Chair, that even smaller equipment that you might use might be recycled in this country without making the effort to. First choice would be somewhere here locally or in the state or somewhere. That's
Madam Chair. Representative Lane.
This particular bill speaks of equipment that has minimal or no resale value. We have in law for 2011 ability to go from municipality to municipality for things that have value. But this one now goes into minimal or no resale value. They can donate it to a nonprofit. So they can do that already. This goes another step to make them not have to junk something just because it's out of code. Maybe you talk about the body gear, the turnout gear.
Chief Gorman.
Madam Chair, one of the ones is our bunker gear, turnout clothes. The standards that are in place, national standards that are in place, that it should be replaced every 10 years. And you know, in my department, we try to do that. We have a replacement schedule every year. The ones that are at that point. A lot of departments. I have paid on call firefighters and some full-time firefighters, and some of that gear, even in 10 years, is probably maybe only seen one or two actual fires in that time frame. Most of it's just been training and things like that. So it is in really good condition, but it's not something you want to pass on to other departments in this country because it doesn't meet the standards. Not that I would. The sad part is I believe there's probably a lot of small towns, rural towns that would actually take it, and I know a lot of them probably do take it, and that's sort of a sad situation on the other side. But things like that, sending that over to countries where they don't have any turnout gear at all, it does provide them a lot higher level of safety than fighting fires, what they're doing now in street clothes. So it gives them some protection. But even small equipment, when I have equipment and things, I advertise it on our state chief's website. Most of the fire departments are into that, and I get emails right away a lot of times when I have decent, good equipment from some town, and they want it, and right away, sure, come and take it. I don't, unless it's something a very expensive type items, most of the smaller stuff, if I've had it for 20 years, 25 years, I usually just donate it to those other departments, especially the outstate rural ones, because I know they don't have a lot of funds for it, and they just appreciate being able to get it.
Great. Okay, members, Representative Elaine, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask maybe the researchers. On line 1.21, is there any reason why it's written that way, the "and" and cellular phones? I'm just wondering why it wouldn't say, including but not limited to cellular phones and emergency medical and firefighting equipment.
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, this
Representative Runbeck.
Madam Chair and Ms. Dyson, the sentence just reads awkwardly, I guess, is all.
Ms. Dyson?
Including but not limited to, seems to me to be a more appropriate way to say it. What do I know? But because you're not just limiting it to those types of items, it could be other things as well.
Okay.
I will make that an oral amendment, unless there's any meaning I'm missing, but I don't think so.
So, sure. Just so I've got it correctly, Representative Runbeck, you're looking on H1003-2, page 1, line 21. You want to do what, if you could repeat again?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Dyson?
If I understand what you're saying, Representative Runbeck, in saying it is and, because the Public Works Department, that was an addition in the Government Operations Committee relating to other types of equipment. The bill as introduced was just cellular phones, emergency medical, and firefighting equipment. It was a subset of that, and then in the GovOps Committee it was added in because there's other types of equipment in the Public Works Department that is in addition to it. So it's not that cellular phones, emergency medical, and firefighting equipment are included in the Public Works Department. I think it was they were seen as separate concepts, and there was actually more that was added in GovOps that came out in civil law. So there have been a couple of changes along the way, but I don't think adding in including but not limited to the two are separate, and I think they were meant to be.
Does that make sense?
I guess I would defer to the author and on that as well.
And does it help, Representative Runbeck, if you get a chance to visit in between time? And I'm sure Representative Lane would be willing to work with you on that.
Madam Chair, it's really not significant at all.
Okay. All right. Representative Lane?
Madam Chair, that in GovOps, we love this bill to death.
Okay.
Well, not to death, but we love this bill so much we added more things to it from the previous mayors and city council people, and then we had to take a little bit out when Joel Carlson said that it interfered with the 2011 law, and so we've come down to a happy medium here.
Okay. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just think that the first two ands we could probably take off and leave the commas. I think it would read better then, but that's beside the point. But I will tell you, we send a lot of I've worked with sending a lot of equipment down to Guatemala, and there's a lot of rural departments that would love to have any equipment, and even though it doesn't meet standards, it's better than what they got. So I truly support this. As a
members, any other comments? All right, Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 1003 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, it goes to the General Register.
Thank you.
And with that, members, we are adjourned.